This is the part of the Random Radio Show that becomes Mex Tape with me, Paul Mex. And this week, I'm talking to War of the Worlds maestro Jeff Wayne, who's shortly coming to our fair city of Brighton for two dates at the Brighton Centre on December 16th and 17th. So here we are with Mr. Jeff Wayne yet again. We meet kind of around about the same time every year. Welcome to Radio Reverb. No stranger, are you, Jeff?
No, Paul. It's great to see you and chat to you again, but I've become very familiar with Radio Reverb. It's a great station.
Thank you very much. So, War of the Worlds coming back to Brighton again at the Brighton Centre, the 16th and 17th of December. Once again, you've got new things in the show. To start off with, Richard Burton's no longer in it.
No, it's part of a new production called The War of the Worlds, The New Generation, and I sort of revisited the story, the score, and we've re-recorded the album with new guest artists. It stemmed from re-exploring the story, in fact, and Richard's performance, which was brilliant. I was thrilled to secure him for the original album, and he was brought back to life on all four previous tours, but his performance was finite. You know, sadly, he passed away in 1984, and to expand the story, the central character is the role that he played, that of a journalist who had survived this Martian invasion some 6 years earlier, and he's now recounting his story of survival for his newspaper. So to expand the story, it unfortunately impacted on his role. And just to give you as a statistic, Richard did 74 sequences on the album and therefore in the live tours, whereas Liam Neeson, who's the new journalist, he has 90 sequences. So it gives you an idea of how much we've expanded the story, and as a result, the score has been expanded. One of the things about working with Liam is inevitably, as a living actor, we had creative opportunities that we could never have done bringing Richard back to life. So Richard was only ever seen in one way, which was sort of an 11-foot high floating holographic performance. Liam, we've done in three different ways. One is similar to Richard, where it's more than head and shoulders. You see him standing, you see him sit down at a desk, he has props in his hand, just more movement. It's just an advancement both on the technology and the fact that he was a living actor that we could work with. A second way is that he's seen on stage in full body, interacting with the characters who are singing or acting. We're not sure it's ever been done before in this sort of detail. We don't have many moments like this in the new production, two or three, but they're little cherries. Yeah, cherries on a cake on a Sunday. For example, the artilleryman, Ricky Wilson, who has just survived the first wave of the Martian landing on Horsell Common in Woking in Surrey, escapes away from the area, and he thinks he's taking shelter in an abandoned house. He's disheveled, he's a bit bloodied, only to discover it's the journalist who's equally escaped from Horsell Common to get back to his own home, and he's there, and he sees the artilleryman sort of crawling in and taking shelter, but he takes pity on him and offers him a drink. Well, this is Liam full body on stage and as a 3D hologram, and Ricky's live on stage, and he hands him a drink.
Wow. That also sounds like a technical nightmare. It sounds like there could be a lot of scope for something to go wrong. Has that happened?
Well, I'll tell you after this tour's over. This is the first time we're doing it.
In previous years, has the hologram gone wrong?
We've had moments, the odd show, where the synchronization of audio has slipped and it's out of sync with the voice. There was a series of commercials with Joan Collins and Leonard Rossiter some years ago.
Cinzano Bianco.
That's the one. And they get slightly out of sync.
Yeah.
Well, and you laugh a lot at those commercials. Yeah. Unfortunately, it also happened with us. So we've had things like that. But the trickier bits are for the live performers on stage who had to interact with Richard's hologram, even though it's one type only, because they're living people and timing to precision timings, because Richard is in the right place at the right time every night, as will Liam be. And we've had moments where they've lost the timing and they're talking while he's talking, or they finished and there's a very long pregnant gap and I'm up in the podium looking at my watch. Come on, guys, now. You're out of sync there.
I'm predicting a riot. I just slipped in somewhere, sorry. I mean, getting somebody like Liam Neeson, I mean, he's a huge Hollywood star. How do you go about doing something like that?
Well, you know, it's been like very parallel to securing Richard Burton. It was good fortune. That's all I can put it down to. When Liam was approached. It was through an agent of his in New York, and he came back with an immediate interest to the point where in about 2 days of hearing about it, we were in New York meeting with him at an apartment that he had that he uses as an office. He had just finished a film and was spending some time with his two sons in New York where they live, and he was then going off to do 4 movies in a row, as it turned out. So this time was important to him. So we went to him. What I didn't know at the time is that he bought the album when it first came out.
Right.
And with many of the guest artists, particularly on the New Generation recording, it was because they knew the album and either had copies of it or grew up with it with their parents or something like that. And that was really, coming back to Liam Neeson, the key is that he knew the album and was really pleased to be invited to participate on the role that Richard did. In fact, he referred to it before making up his mind. He said, it's the demons. And I thought, he's Irish. Maybe it's something to do with Irish traditions or something that means something. And then he went on to say, no, it's the demon of following Richard Burton.
I mean, they're big shoes to fill, aren't they?
Yeah, but part of the thing that convinced him was that this wasn't just an exact replication of what Richard performed. And that's why, coming back to that statistic, it gives an idea of how much his role has grown. So it's given him a lot of new material, as well as the existing material, but to reinterpret in his own way. And he said, you don't want me to do a Richard Burton, do you? Nobody can do that anyway. I said, no, I want you to do a Liam Neeson. That's why I'm here sitting talking to you.
Did he drink less?
Actually, you know, when I worked with Richard, he definitely came with a reputation, drinking being part of that.
You kind of worked with quite a lot of rebel rousers, didn't you? Because you also worked with Phil Lynott.
Yeah, but Richard, my memory is that he had one beer. Coors beer was his drink on the recording sessions. And subsequent times that I spent with him, I never saw him drink anything more than what you'd call his social drinking.
So the new breed, because you've got other new artists in the show, do you get any hell raising?
Well, we haven't started touring yet. Let's discuss this after the tour.
I have to touch upon somebody I always touch upon with you. Chris Bedding, is he playing guitar again for you?
Yeah, he's back. He is. Yeah, and Herbie Flowers.
A local boy.
Yes, indeed.
I understand Marty Pello's in the show. So what made you choose Marty?
I'm asked, how did you choose so-and-so? And I always sort of qualify by saying, anybody of any stature, you don't choose. You just hope they'll be attracted to whatever project you're working on. And that was the case with Marty. It was the case with everybody. All very successful in their own careers. I felt very fortunate to attract all the new guest stars, both on the album and both on the tour. Marty being one of them.
I'm presuming then you're a Kaiser Chiefs fan.
I was, even before meeting Ricky. In a way, with almost everybody that I've worked with, again, either on the new album or the tour, I knew their work and regarded their work in varying degrees. I had only ever seen Kaiser Chiefs on TV. Our director, Mika Brighese, and I went to see a Kaiser Chiefs gig, not because of the album, because Ricky was first committed to do the album. It was to discuss the tour with him. But the way he commands the stage, even though he's not trained as an actor in the sense, he has so much stage presence.
He's got a kind of a punk rock spirit, hasn't he?
Yes, he does, and it's bringing that to this role of the artilleryman, and Mika has been excited by that, because everybody who's done all the roles, in fact, you know, they come with usually stage experience, with small exception. So working with Ricky has been a great challenge, and the result so far in their rehearsals together is that sort of element that he brings to his day job as a lead singer for Kaiser Chiefs, translated into this role of an artilleryman who's got this vision for mankind's survival underground.
And you've got Jason Donovan in the show again.
Yeah, now that's interesting, because when you say again, you're absolutely right, but in a different role.
Yeah, because last year he played the artillery
man. That's right. What it made me think of Jason being Parson Nathaniel, which is this character who is a parson who you'd think in times of stress in our world, like a Martian invasion would be. You go to your, in the Victorian times, your local man of the cloth and hopefully gain spiritual and moral comfort. But in fact, Parson Nathaniel is the first person that loses and just goes totally bonkers. He thinks the Martians are the devil and only he can save the world now. But with it, he loses all hope for the survival of mankind and loses all faith in himself. And it's his wife, Beth is her name. She's the one that's trying to bring him back from his insanity and to reinstill hope and love in his heart. Phil Lynott played it on the album, and we've had some really mad characters playing it on our previous tours in a nice way. But Jason, when we came to thinking about Parson Nathaniel for the new tour, I had just read an interview that he had done, and he said that he wanted to expand his own skills and try to find something dramatic that nobody would associate the type of role that he's been known for. And I thought, you know, because he's so good as a performer, as an actor, as a singer, he might be up for the challenge. In other words, I'll make him eat his own words. So I emailed him. I said, okay, I've read your interview. Here's the role for you. He came back. He said, ooh, I think I better accept the challenge. So he's now Parson Nathaniel. And that's quite unusual. In fact, I'm not even sure it's ever been done before, where a leading artist artist, plays a role in, could be a Western musical or whatever, and comes back and does another major role in the same piece. So it's a real challenge for him. He's got it already.
So, I mean, it sounds like something that actually possibly could have happened in Dallas.
Probably.
Which is back on TV again.
So I understand.
It's the new generation. What will people be able to look forward to in it kind of being different?
Well, I think it's a totality. What it isn't is a giant sort of mashing up to show how clever I can be with club remixes and things and have a totally understandable story. It's not trying to do a club remix of the score, but what it is, it's an expansion of the story. There's new musical content. It's been totally rearranged and re-recorded, and it sounds very fresh and modern without trying to be so off the wall that doesn't relate to anything. And I think for those who don't know the album or know the show, who might hear it, might see it, they'll just judge it on its own merit.
Right.
For those who know the original, it will be very interesting, because those who have stayed with me all these years on the original, be it the show or, of course, the album, they've been attracted to it and stayed with it because of original artists, the way it sounded, which was much more prog rock, I guess, if you want to call it that, or some mixture of that and symphonic strings and aggressive guitar work and synthesizers. This is a reimagination of it, but I do think that it's a very good companion to the original, and nobody will be let down. I hope that's the case, because I wouldn't have spent 2 years putting it under the microscope if I didn't feel it sort of hit the mark for my own sort of checklist. And of course, as a musician, it's given me an opportunity to reimagine it as if I was sitting down today to compose and produce it. The original, I remain proud of. It's not anything that was broken, so, you know, you could ask, well, why try to fix something that's not broken?
Yeah.
I'm not trying to fix it. I'm trying to reimagine it.
Right.
That's what I hope. And even the artwork has been totally reimagined.
Yeah, I mean, because you're sort of crossing boundaries there, because the show's sort of been expanded upon, but you're also kind of walking into the territory of the new album, aren't you?
That's right. In a way, by having a new tour that's virtually within days of the album coming out, they're companions to each other, and the new artwork is quite startlingly brilliant, in my opinion. It's not been done by hand painting, it's been done on computers, but you wouldn't know that, I think, when anybody sees it, regardless of what people think of the album and the show. The artwork has its own magic about it, and we've incorporated it into what's pretty much all new animation. So the whole experience will be quite different.
Talking about computers, recording has changed so much since you recorded the original. In the old days, it was recorded on analog, and now it's digital.
Exactly. It doesn't stop there, Paul, because in the era that I composed it, these were handwritten arrangements, and I booked a band.
Yeah.
I was one of them, other than two pieces that needed conducting because they were virtually without a tempo. Everything else was band-orientated, so I would just count the guys in from one of the keyboards I was on, 1, 2, 1, 2, 3, 4, and off we went. And we just kept doing it over and over until it was tight. We go in and listen to a playback. Yeah, well, that's good, or no, we can do better. Get back in there, guys. Let's here we go and do it again. But compare tightness by live performers, and we were a good band. When you look at some of the guys on it, you know.
Well, top guys. I mean, we've already mentioned Chris Bedin and Herbie Flowers.
Yeah, but everyone were governors of their own instruments of that day. But playing without a click, just as a band playing live, which is how I conceived it. Compare that with computer tightness, and it's amazing how different it sounds.
Yeah.
And we started by spending 3 months tempo mapping the original score. Other than those two pieces, again, have still stayed very free. And then began with new drums, both electronic and real.
I mean, some people would argue that maybe you won't be able to capture the feel with the computerized approach to it. Have you kind of overcome that?
I think I have. It's getting pretty close to where it's going to be judged. I wouldn't have spent 2 years on anything, much less reimagining something that has been so successful, if I didn't really believe it had merit in today's terms, on all the major tick boxes. So the story, the score, the production values, and things that I can do today. It convinced me by going through it very detailed before making the decision to do it.
Did you record it all in Pro Tools?
Yep, all Pro Tools. It started with the tempo mapping, but all the live performances, all new keyboard work, of which I did a large part of it, everything that has built up this new production was a digital Pro Tools production. But it still sounds very human, but it's darker, it's tighter, just because it is computer generated.
So is the bulk of the new recording primarily you, or have you used other musicians?
No, it's a range of new musicians.
Right. New musicians, so does that mean Herbie and Chris aren't on it?
No, they're still new to me. They'll always be new to me, because they're playing as good as ever, if not better. Now, so there are some pieces that they came in and put new performances on. Some of it we tested with computers, just playing a bass line, just to get a feel, and then played it to Herbie, and he took it on from there.
you've been rubbing shoulders with a rather famous young man from Take That.
Robbie Williams. No,
never. Not the arrogant chubby one, the nice one, the songwriter one.
Yeah, Gary Barlow, what a delight, what a lovely man. I met him, we met up for lunch, we exchanged a few emails just to see whether it might be of interest to him and whether he had time, because he was committed to so many things. When I met with Gary, he was still involved in the Queen's Jubilee song. It was a TV documentary of how he made it all, which was fascinating, and the concert itself, which he both put together and performed on, and that's quite a mighty challenge. That was just the beginning of things he's committed to. The X Factor, most people know about, and other things. So I got an email back very quickly from Gary saying, yeah, I'd love to be involved. And in fact, it turns out he knew the album very well, was influenced by it, as he said, as a keyboardist with all the synthesizers and work I had done with it on the original. So we then met up for lunch and talked through how we might work together, and he came on board.
I mean, he seems like a really nice chap. He's also a producer and composer within his own right. Do you ever get intimidated working with some of these other musicians?
No, I get excited because I start with the highest of respect. But, yeah, you know, once you start working, two people that get on are there to do what? But to make something special out of their experience working together. So I got excited with everybody, and Gary was no less somebody that I was excited to work with. I think he felt similarly for different reasons, because he just had copies of The War of the Worlds and admired it. So there was a great respect from me to him, and I think it came back from him to me. And,
right. Another thing I just want to ask you, for anybody who hasn't seen the show, why not? Get down to the Brighton Centre, 16th and 17th of December. Tickets always sell out. There's still some available at the moment, isn't it?
I think the second show has a few. I'm not sure, but they're pretty close to sold out.
If you haven't booked your ticket, get in there quick. But you're up on your podium, and you've kind of got an orchestra on one side of you and the rock band on the other side. One thing I noticed last year, keep coming back to Chris Bedding, he's one of my favourite guitarists. So everybody's taking direction from you. I noticed last year, Chris just seemed to be in a world of his own. Is he actually really taking any direction from you? Because it looks like he's just doing his own thing, which is superb, I'd say.
When we leave the venue, he says, what's the directions to the next city? Other than that, no. No, he does, but he's, as you've seen, and that's part of his own reputation, he isn't what you'd call one of these jumping guitarists that has all these moves.
Yeah.
But listen to his playing, and it's genius. But occasionally he does look up certain moments. Almost everybody has a quantity of moments that they always look up for a cue, and other times only when they need to. And as you get more and more familiar with your own performances, they need less. I throw every cue to be at the band or the strings, because that's what the conductor does. It sends the right cues, or dynamic barkings. You're playing a little too loud, or come on, I need a little more out of you at that given moment. I'm there when needed. Orchestral instruments tend to look up all the time.
Yeah.
Maybe that's the training, the formal training, whereas band members are probably different just by the nature of what they play.
Right. So we got the War of the World stuff out of the way. Now onto the real business. How's the tennis going?
Hey, now we're into the real priority stuff here. Well, I'm proud to say that I've just finished my 22nd year captaining the county of Hertfordshire's men tennis team. These are all the guys between sort of 17 and mid to late 20s. When I took over 22 years ago, we were in group 4 in the summer competition, group 6 in the winter. There's 8 groups. Like football, you play up as high as you can get, so Premier League would be the equivalent of group 1 for us. We've been in group 1 in the summer for 8 years, 6 years in the winter, and we've won the national title 5 years out of 8 in the summer, and we're going for 6 in a row in a few weeks.
Congratulations. Yeah,
thank you. Now, we're the number one men's team, and have been for several years, in Great Britain. Very proud of it. I have a great bunch of players. They're great guys. We're very tight as mates, because that's partly what makes up a good team.
Yeah.
We have a famous win over North of Scotland, which was 3 summers ago, when on the third day, Andy and Jamie Murray showed up, and we won. We won 5-4 in a real nail-biter. So in tennis terms, that was a famous win for us.
I kind of feel an affinity with that, because being a Hertfordshire boy myself.
Yeah, indeed. So. You are.
And we do know mutual tennis people, don't we?
We do, yeah.
Well, always a pleasure, Jeff, to see you down here in Brighton.
Thank you, Paul. Great
and,
to see you.
And hopefully it hasn't been too blustery for you.
As I always remember Brighton.
Wet and blustery. We won't go there again. Thanks a lot for joining me today, Jeff, and I'll see you in December, 16th and the 17th, at Brighton Centre, and look forward to the new show.
Good. Well, I hope you enjoy it, and I look forward to seeing you then.
Thanks a lot, Jeff.
Thank you.